When I approach a poem and I approach it in a way where you want to experience it first, for me, again, it's a way of honoring that place, it's honoring language. But there's always this sort of notion or this drive or something that pulls us toward wanting to extract things from it, right? Which is both very, you know, in a literal sense, very real, right? When you think about, in order for us to have these things in our daily life, these conveniences, it's relied on extraction from those fields, whether it be coal, you know, gases, right? Those types of things. So from my eyes, it's sort of American progress is always driven by native populations or indigenous populations, right? Whether it be native tribes themselves and the resources they have on their lands, but also, right, when we think about labor, right, the way the most, talking about sort of undocumented immigrants and the workforce that they bring to America, right? It's sort of, and of course we can talk about, you know, historically America, right, talking about its foundation in, you know, slave labor, right? The idea that it's always on the backs of black and brown bodies that America is able to sort of progress and, you know, become this nation, right? And so for me, that's all under this precursor of this mindset of you have to understand something or you have to be able to overcome it, which I think is maybe just an anxiety or fear that we all have inherent as sort of people. And so when we approach free verse, right, there's this idea where then the page is this open thing that we can then conquer, right? We don't have structures, we don't have form, we don't have anything like that, so we're just going to approach the page how we want to, right? For me, that's it, and I totally agree with what Natalie retweeted or quoted from another I think poet scholar about the imperial mindset and free verse, right? It's this idea of conquering the page with your own sort of structures. And so when I tell my students there's no such thing as free verse, it's always on sort of with the understanding that we approach poetry not for extraction but for honoring and acknowledging things that exist, right? And so I always go back to the metaphor of the field, right? It's not just there. Forces and structures and systems have made that possible through, you know, millennia of sort of processes over time. And so when you're looking at a field, you're not just looking at wildlife, you're not just looking at plant life, you're not just looking at nature, you're looking at time and the way time has evolved through the years so that you're able to see physically and touch, you can touch time with those particular fields.
Hmm. Well, at one point in this essay, Poetry as Field, you say, the function of the poet is to remind us that there is a field there, even if we don't give it language. Poetry becomes the field, bringing function back to art. And then you go on to wonder about art versus function when a friend of yours tells you of his trouble with the term native art, because in his mind there is no such thing as native art, because art to Dene is not aesthetic but functional. Then you ask the question of quote-unquote native art, whether it is something beyond art or whether it exists in a different lexicon than aesthetic versus functional. And I love how you answer it by refusing to answer it in language, which goes back to the beginning lines. You say, the question remains, is it art? What is art? And your answer is, there is a field. We don't question its meaning or try to find narrative or accessibility. There is simply a field. That just feels brilliant. It's like a koan, but it also feels like it's the true answer at the same time.
I feel like when I was writing that essay, I was having all these questions about art and function. And then I began to think maybe I'm asking the wrong questions, or I'm asking a different type of question that I'm not certain I even want the answer to, right? Mm-hmm. Which is, right, I mean, even if we talk about, sort of like this lexicon of art and function, it's still not getting to the essence, right? The fact that this artifact, like art, or this thing, like a field, is existing, right? And when we're just sort of stuck in language a little bit, I mean, not necessarily, a poetic language, but like just the colonial or English language, we're forgetting that this thing exists, right?
Yeah.
And so for me, that's That's sort of what I feel is the responsibility of myself as a poet, is just letting people know that we are often overlooking things.
But it reminded me a little of a talk I went to this last summer of Natalie Diaz, where she talked about how outside the reservation, she has to navigate being a much sought after poet. But then when she goes home, people aren't very impressed with her being a poet. They want to know what action it creates, what impact it has. And she's now taking those questions seriously, looking to put her poetry in motion in a way in response to those questions. So I don't know if she's looking for necessarily to answer the aesthetic versus functional, but she's definitely taking both sides of that conundrum seriously.
All Native poets probably wrestle with that idea of how then is poetry activism, right? Which is sort of the basis of this essay, right? It was the theme of World Literature Day's issue was literary activism and what that meant. And so for me, when I approach the idea of action, right, I think poetry is, in my opinion, right, it's because it's entirely my opinion, I think poetry is most in sort of is very similar to this notion of decolonization and things like that, right? Because we're dealing with a language that's colonial, that's imperial, that displaces and disappears people. But we're trying to find depth for it, and we're trying to give it a capacity for beauty, give it a capacity for reflection. For me, that's a very active sort of thing that you're doing with language. You're wrestling, you're molding it, and you're trying to give it back to your people. And I think for people within Native nations and Native communities, I mean, I definitely understand why they would want to see, you know, this physical reaction, right, or this physical active thing that you have to be doing, right? And I think that's just, you know, molded, I think, maybe a little bit out of anxiety, right, a little bit out of fear for just living in those types of spaces, right? So they want to see change, they want to see action. And I think as poets, we are doing it. It's just a little bit more quiet, maybe a little more on the quiet end. But, you know, I definitely do see the merit in terms of wanting to bring action and activism to poetry. And I think it's definitely possible.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking to poet Jake Skeets about his debut poetry collection from Milkweed entitled Eyes Bottle Dark with a Mouthful of Flowers. If one of your collections was to be about violence and Gallup and another your coming out collection, I wanted to ask you about love and desire in relationship to the land. And I'm going to quote something you once said. On my Instagram, I have the label Loverboy only because I love love. I love love songs, romantic comedies, breakup songs, sad relationship songs, and any other art form that is made out of love. My newer poems are beginning to challenge the definition of love because my idea of love has evolved so much since moving home to the reservation. Love from a Diné perspective looks a lot different, and I want to explore that. And I was hoping maybe you could explore it a little bit with us. Talk to us about this different model of love that challenges the love that you experienced.
When I wrote that post, I was sort of thinking about the function of love and the way it's defined. Because, you know, I just moved home and I was sort of seeing everything again as sort of a, you know, this new fresh, you know, quote unquote adulthood, right? Because I left when I was just a high school graduate. And so I began to notice how sort of like the, you know, Hallmark version of love or, you know, those types of things don't really exist back home, right? And I was thinking about my parents a lot and how they sort of operate as a relationship, as a married couple. And I was looking at also my aunts and their husbands, and I was just thinking about even my own relationship too, and thinking about how we don't celebrate a Valentine's Day type of love, right? We don't, you know, get hearts or things like that for our significant others. For me, back home, and this is probably true for a lot of Native communities, but specifically for Diné, our love is expressed through labor and through energy, right? Mm. You show someone you love them not by saying it, but by, you know, doing it, right? So by doing something for them, right? Or, you know, showing you care for them through your own actions, trying to, just make them, or just be there for them, basically, right? So I have this, I was thinking about this example where a cousin of mine, I think, not a cousin of mine, but, well, I guess technically a cousin, but they're like a family friend's child, right? But we call them cousins, even though we're not really related, was stuck in like Las Cruces. And we were trying to find a way for them to get back, right? And again, this is not my blood relative or anything like that. It's just we were all sort of coming together to try and find a way to get this person back from Las Cruces. And so then we just decided, hey, let's have someone drive all the way out to Las Cruces and bring them back, which for me is sort of very sort of strange, because, you know, we're not related to this person, but at the end of the day, we still went out of our way to, you know, show that we care for this particular person. And so it's a really interesting sort of place to be in, especially as a sort of queer person being in that type of relationship back home, right? It's very, we have to be very conscious about how we express our relationship to people, both our own families, but also just the general public. It's just, for me, I think I'm very interested in the idea of love and the idea of joy now, especially after such a grief-heavy collection. I've just been thinking about it still, sort of wrestling with it.
Well, I picked out more poems I was hoping we could hear.
Dear brother, you kissed a man the way I do, but with a handgun. You called it. I'm the fag we were afraid to know. The one we throw rocks at, huff at like horses. I learned to touch a man by touching myself. I learned to be a man by loving one. Prison is not the chicken wire we'd get tangled in. Remember our bloodied knees and bloody palms from mangled handlebars, beer bottles, and cactus spines. Remember the horned toad we didn't mean to kill. Our silence, thick as the dust kicked up by our skinny legs. You are still that silence, still that boy holding a deflated body with your dawning hands. Thieving ceremony. You've come for me twice before, body swollen with booze, fires for eyes. Each time I let you have me and let you cry. Let me heal you. It is your hands that touch me. We become the black wool of a night sky every time. Slide out of our clothes in a back seats in a back room, black as a Yeti mask. We kiss caesura to ensure the blackening. We are first man and turquoise boy, ash married in a ceremony that is ours now. Make charcoal of the boys before us who have only come to make love to the mass graves in our teeth. To them, our flesh is still soot, still furnace, still jet, still a cornstalk and juniper tree left burning.
I've been listening to Jake Skeets read from Eyes Bottle Dark with A Mouthful of Flowers. Well, speaking of a different sort of love, you've also said that your life changed when you read Lucy Tapahanso in high school and then had the opportunity to study with her in undergrad. And I'd be curious to hear what about her work changed things for you. And also just, you worked under a lot of really renowned poets, Sherwin Bitsui and Joan Cain and others. Maybe you could share some of the wisdom or insight or moments that were pivotal moments for you as a writer.
For Lucy, she's actually my grandmother through clan, which I found out when I first met her. So we have this sort of deeper relationship, I think. And so for me, when I read Lucy for the first time, it sort of showed me that being a poet was possible, that a Diné person could make a life out of being a poet. And the way she sort of reads her books, reads her poems, are very, very Diné, very sort of, she reads it like the way my aunts would read their poetry, right? Her accent and the way she pronounces words and things like that are very home to me. So for me, it sort of showed me that the language we use back home is sort of already poetic in a way. In my poetry class at Diné College, we had one exercise where I asked them to go to a grocery store and eavesdrop on people just to see what they would say. And one of my students came back with a quote that they heard by a mother there, and I think it was Walmart in Gallup. And the mother was on the phone, and the mother said, "Tell me what you want, because I don't want to go all the way back to come all the way back." And just that phrase, "I don't want to go all the way back to come all the way back," right, is so interesting and so poetic in my mind, because it's using language, it's using sounds, it's using everything in a way that's so poet from a poet. And so I think Lucy has that ability to where she understands that the stories she heard as a child were poems, and she was able to capture that and translate that onto the page. And so in terms of Lucy, I think it's this idea of translating what we hear in our homes and by our parents, by our aunts, by our grandparents, right? This oral tradition of storytelling. And Lucy showed me a way to translate that onto the page, right? And so it's, you know, in terms of like Sherwin, and he's also a very big mentor for me. I met him in undergrad, back, I think it was 2013, 14, around there. Very long time I've been talking with Sherwin. And I think Sherwin was the sort of big sort of figure for me in terms of image and really pushing image and making sure I earn language, right? I would always have to make sure that I earn all the metaphors or similes that I use, right? Especially if I use the word like or as they would literally stop me in my tracks and say, "Why are you using like?" Justify it, and then maybe we can use it. If you can't justify it, then maybe you should get rid of it and push the image a little bit further.
And you've mentioned also that Sherwin wanted you to have the physical manuscript on your body, and he would surprise you and check to see whether the manuscript was on you. Talk to us about that. What was that about? Because he also practices this with his own work.
Yeah, it was just his advice to me. Well, maybe an assignment, because I was technically under his mentorship. Yeah, and it was just for his justification, it was a way to become one with the book, to internalize the book so that you can really understand its forces and really understand its energies, and so that when it comes to ordering the collection, you're able to approach it both as a poet but also just as a person, right? That you've become so part of this that you now know its nuances and you know its turns and you know its breaks, and the ordering will become a bit more organic that way. So that was one thing that he wanted me to sort of do with this particular manuscript, was become part of it. And I think also just in terms of craft, in terms of being a poet, I think also making sure that you're working on it, right? That if you're like,
it's always
waiting
on you.
Yeah, it's always on you. So if you're waiting for a bus, or you're in a restaurant waiting for food, or it's something that you're doing that you have time, you can pull it out and start working on it.
Yeah. Well, I want to read something else something you said in an interview online at Shade Literary Arts. You don't ask a Native person to define community, especially from the Navajo Nation. I could go on for hours telling you about the physical and cultural communities of my parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, and clan relations. Then I could talk about the colonial influence of Western versus Eastern Navajo, New Mexico Navajo versus Arizona Navajo, border town Navajo, checkerboard Navajo. Then I would also have to find a footing within the LGBTQQIA plus community, which rattles me so much because I feel I still don't belong there. Then maybe discuss schools of poetics or poetic communities that have informed my work, like language poets or more recently Deep Image. I would find room for Diné poetics and Diné poets like Sherwin Bitsui and Lucy Tapahanso, both related to me by clan, which would go back to the physical and cultural communities. Then I would have to imagine my current communities on and off the reservation, maybe even talk about how the people on the bus with me is a community or how my MFA poetry cohort is a community. So as simply as possible, I would define community as a place where you understand your place, practice goodwill, and contribute in some capacity. I love that. I love that conception of community. And I guess I was interested after, now that we've talked about some of your mentors at IAI, if we could hear about some of the other poetic communities too. You mentioned language poetry and Deep Image. And what are those to you? And who among those communities are people that influence your writing?
Yeah, definitely. I think in terms of school poetics, schools of poets and schools of poetry, yeah, definitely. I mean, language poets, I first came across in my postmodernism class as an undergrad. Yeah, it was just a way of looking at language differently. Deep Image as well was a recommendation by Santi Fraser during my IAI, and through Deep Image, I found the Black Mountain poets, so Charles Olson, Robert Creeley, Levertov, Jack Spicer, sort of these poets who, and I think, were very, very close to understanding a Diné way of thinking as non-Diné, right? Mm-hmm. They were very close to understanding how we think and how we approach the world, which is why I rely on them a lot to teach Diné thought and Diné poetics, because I don't want to, you know, be breaching, you know, I mean, breaching sort of like the care of Diné story or traditions or things like that. So I take very good care of that, and I make sure that I'm not sort of, you know, sharing things I'm not supposed to be sharing. So I rely on specifically Black Mountain poets, because they were so close to understanding how we think. And for me, with language poets, Deep Image and Black Mountain, I think Jack Spicer says it best when he says, you know, poets are sort of antennas for language, or we are just sort of vehicles for language. For me, that's a very Diné type of thinking, where we are not necessarily in the center, right? The center is elsewhere. And I think when I first met Joy Hodges, she also expressed that type of advice to me. Mm-hmm. I asked her sort of, you know, what advice do you have for an emerging poet, right? And her answer was, it's about listening. Right? Mm. It's about listening, learning to listen to things around you, learning to listen to the airwaves, learning to listen to things that push you or that force you to write. Mm. It's an interesting sort of relationship to have with language when you're constantly listening to it, because you sort of begin to hear all the turns and breaks and things like that. And you also begin to negotiate, right? It's some of its more harmful things, right? Because right now we are living in a country that's sort of molded by a language rooted in violence, right? Even just, you know, the way the president tweets, right? It's using language in a way that's taking freedoms away, you know, displacing and disappearing people. So I think, as poets, we should always be at the forefront of listening to language and learning it again.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that reminds me of a story you've told of a conversation between Lucy Tapahanso and her father, where her father says to her that the words of the Diné language are hers to use, but that the words of English should be used with extreme caution. And I wondered if it sounds like that rings true for you, but I'd love to hear more about how you think poetry is a key to maybe finding a different dimension in English than the one that you're hearing when you listen to it, like when you hear Trump tweet.
In terms of poetry, because we say because for poets we put sort of pay very close attention to what we write, right? It's for me the best way to honor language and relearn the capacity for language, because you know we spend so much time on the surface and its depth and its meaning. So in terms of poetry, that's really a gateway into understanding or relearning language all over again. And you're right. And so in terms of really just thinking about taking care of what you say, right? Really thinking about what you say. And I think now that we live in, you know, the Twitterverse, right? We sort of forget things. I mean, I don't necessarily forget. Maybe we just take for granted a little bit the language we have. English is such an interesting young language, right? It's sort of moving away from its original intent, right? Because English is like a trader's language, right? It was created so that a lot of different communities could talk to each other. Hmm. So it has a really interesting sort of intent, and it has a really interesting history, right? When you think about the alphabet, we think about the origins of letters and things like that. It goes back to all these different communities, right? We have roots in all these different languages other than English. But for some reason, it's sort of rooted now in conquest, rooted now in disappearing and displacement. And I think poetry is the best way to go against that, right? Because you're trying to bring this concept of beauty back to English. Mm. And so in terms of English itself, the way I use language is I borrow the depth of Navajo or the depth of Diné, because it's sort of language structures are so interesting, very poetic, but I'm not a fluent speaker at all, so I really can't use any specific words or phrases or things like that. So I understand its depth, so I try to bring that depth into English a little bit.
Well, I was hoping maybe we could end with one more poem. Mm-hmm. Could you introduce us to and read Red Running Into Water?
So Red Running Into Water is a poem that I wrote specifically about my clans. So each stanza begins with my clan, and I wanted to sort of relate it back to its translation, and also back to this collection about masculinity specifically, and also just about the image that I keep returning to, the idea of the field, the idea of space, and the idea of sort of this speaker, this image of a boy becoming a man in this space and what it meant. So Red Running Into Water is actually the translation of my third clan, or my Che, or my grandfather's clan. Red Running Into Water. Sinajini Nishle. Pronounce the as water whistling through shadow on black bark. The as boy wearing only yucca, lake colored. Tskabaha Bashishchin. The is now mouth of narrow stream, inside a pink mobile home with white skirting. The sounds like pulling hair from the throat, shaped like the Tkachini Dashiche. The now a head busted open, red running into water. The is the boy now naked, red running into water. Twitik ojen dashinele. Boy has the O for mouth, washed with memory of salt water. Pronounce this as rain cloud, belly up. The still the boy floating on the lake, except it is a field. His mouth left O.
Thanks so much for being on the show today, Jake.
No, thank you for having me.
We're talking today to the poet Jake Skeets about his debut collection from Milkweed Editions, Eyes Bottle Dark with a Mouthful of Flowers. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of It's a Wonderful Life on Saturday, December 7th from 8 to 10:30 p.m. at the Old Church Concert Hall in Portland. Fake Radio reenacts the historic radio shows the old-fashioned way, dressed in period clothing and standing with scripts in hand in front of old microphones. They'll recreate the 1947 broadcast of Lux Radio Theater's It's a Wonderful Life, including the commercials and announcements. Again, that's It's a Wonderful Life on Saturday, December 7th from 8 to 10:30 p.m. at the Old Church Concert Hall, 1422 Southwest 11th Avenue in Portland. Again, that's It's a Wonderful Life on Saturday, December 7th from 8 to 10:30 p.m. at the Old Church Concert Hall, 1422 Southwest 11th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of The Season is the Reason Yule Bazaar on Saturday, December 7th from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the Beaverton Masonic Lounge. The Season is the Reason and Other Worlds of Wonder host a bazaar that celebrates all of the beauty and fun of gift-giving during the winter holidays and features local pagan artisans and merchants. Again, that's The Season is the Reason Yule Bazaar on Saturday, December 7th from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the Beaverton Masonic Lounge, 4690 Southwest Watson Ave in Beaverton. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the bright side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Portland's Saturday Market, open daily December 19th through the 24th for the Festival of the Last Minute, offering handmade art, crafts, and gifts by artists in the Pacific Northwest, located at Waterfront Park in downtown Portland. Event schedule, vendor information,